Right now, many churches are planning their budgets for the next fiscal year. Your church can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 on the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. Download the flyer and present it to your congregation today.
I think it's frankly not moral for my generation to keep spending massively more than we take in, knowing those burdens are going to be passed on to the next generation.
If I'm willing to give something up as somebody who's been extraordinarily blessed, I actually think that's going to make economic sense. But for me as a Christian, it also coincides with Jesus' teaching that for unto whom much is given, much shall be required.
In many cases, it's the men who are pressuring women to have abortions. Abortion lets abusive men off the hook.
Let me tell you about my faith. Well, it's okay to say that, but what we're really saying is, let me tell you about Christ.
Confessional Lutheran Deadheads love Issues Etc.
Kind of got lost in the shuffle a little bit, but yesterday there were four ballot initiatives having to do with same-sex marriage. And against expectations of many, all four of them favored gay marriage. And we elected we elected the most pro-abortion president, re-elected him again for another 4 years, knowing his track record on that issue. Are these social issues? Are they like an anchor just holding back the conservative movement? Are they a distraction from more important parts of the conservative agenda? Do we need to become realistic politically and say, look, let's lay those to the side for now and worry about winning some elections? Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. Alan Carlson will be our guest for about a half hour here on this Wednesday afternoon, November the 7th. He's president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society based in Rockford, Illinois. After that, Kristen Day of Democrats for Life will join us. I'd like to know her thoughts on how pro-life Democrats fared yesterday during the election. And then Scott Klusendorf, he'll join us to give us just a picture, if only a short-term picture, of the future of the pro-life movement. He's from the Life Training Institute. You can join us for the next hour as well, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet at Issues ETC. Dr. Alan Carlson is a regular guest, president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, distinguished visiting professor of history and politics at Hillsdale College. He was appointed by President Reagan to the National Commission on Children, and he's author of numerous books, including his latest publication, Godly Seed, American Evangelicals Confront Birth Control. Dr. Carlson, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Always good to be with you.
So here's the kind of the layout. Gay marriage won in all four state ballots where it was on the ballot. We've reelected the most pro-choice president in our country's history. Is it time for politicians to dump social conservatives?
Well, you know what? Social conservatives are going to be blamed for this defeat. This is standard operating procedure over at Republican headquarters in Washington, D.C. The real truth, though, and we should talk about the same-sex marriage initiatives separately, the real truth, though, is that the Romney campaign, while technically pro-life and pro-family, was weak and anemic on these subjects. They were given almost no attention by the official campaign. If you can dig out the official Romney statement on life and family issues, it's short, it's dull, has no passion, and indeed, I find it almost insulting. We do know that the Romney-Ryan ticket was clobbered among African Americans, where they got about 5% of the vote, and among Latinos, where they got only a third of the vote. And these are population groups that are, by large majorities, pro-life, anti-abortion, and certainly anti-same-sex marriage. Nothing was done to reach out to them. That, I think, is the critical difference in the election. It's not because social conservatives fouled up the Republican chances. It's because the campaign did not take an issue that was a natural one for them, and they had to say something about it. They had to run ads in these for the publications, on the television channels that that African Americans and Hispanics watch. They just didn't do it. They did nothing. So I think that's the real story. But you're right; it's not the one that's going to get the main play, I'm afraid.
Okay, you said you'd like to talk a little bit about the gay marriage ballot initiatives. How would you summarize yesterday's events?
Well, it was a serious defeat across the board, but there's some qualifications on that. First of all, the four states that we're talking about, Maine, Maryland, Minnesota, and Washington State, are all liberal states. They have a liberal orientation. The second factor is that in every case, the vote was very, very close, usually 52 to 48, very close votes. A third factor this time is that you have to give credit to the same-sex marriage strategists. They learned from their past lessons, particularly the fellow by the name of Evan Wolfson, who's kind of the chief strategist. And in the past, when these matters had come up for a public vote, they tended to focus on rights, on equal rights. They focused on benefits that married couples get, that gays should have. They realized that was a loser. So they went back about 3 or 4 years ago, went through a complete reorientation of their campaign. This time they were running ads that were all warm and fuzzy. It was all about inclusiveness. It was all about love. It was all about family. And they even had the temerity, but it worked, to claim that they were focusing on parents' rights. They were the advocates of parents' rights, and that in the home is where values are formed, and people shouldn't worry about learning values in public schools. That wasn't going to happen. Home, family, and parents are what are important. So that's what they reoriented their campaign, and I'm afraid we'll call it the defenders of conventional marriage got caught flat-footed and didn't reorient their own campaign to make an effective counter-argument to this very successful effort.
That's a great question embedded there at the last of your answer. What would have been an effective counter-argument to the "this is about love, this is about family, this is about security and parents' rights"? How should we have responded?
Well, I'm afraid we're realizing is that once the issue of the propriety and the acceptability of homosexual behavior, once that's accepted, it's just another way to behave. The steamroll towards the full acceptance of the gay agenda is almost very difficult, if not impossible, to stop. The Catholic Church is about the one institution that still talks that way, at least officially, although not too much publicly. The Pope's position on this is that such behavior is objectively disordered. I think you have to go back to the first square and think about how to convey a message that we're not talking about just another way of being happy, but there's something else that's there that's in homosexual behavior that is not healthy for a society and not healthy for children.
Okay. It's not popular to say this among the advocates of natural marriage. I consider myself one of them. But you seem to indicate there that while there's not an inevitability to this, we may have crossed a cultural threshold. Those percentages, 52 to 48%, are close. But I wonder whether or not they also represent a tipping point where culturally the majority of Americans, regardless of where they fall on the issue, aren't willing to fight about this. Now, most of the time when you say that, the advocates of natural marriage will say, don't say that, don't say it, you're going to jinx us. We can still win this. What do you say?
Well, you may be right. The other thing that's happening, which again doesn't get much attention in the mainstream press, is the intimidation of people who defend same-sex marriage, scholars who publish papers which tell the truth about the effects of such relationships on children. They're harassed. There have been some prominent pro-family leaders who've been faced with crippling lawsuits, with attacks on their very livelihood. A prominent case, a woman who had signed a petition, a prominent prominent academic who'd signed a petition to encourage the vote in Maryland, was fired from her job because of that at a well-known university. The other side is how we say it, is fully committed, fully warmed up, ready to use everything from warm and fuzzy to outright harassment to achieve their ends. I'm afraid the pro-family side, the pro-marriage side, is moving fairly dully, and not coming up with much of a response.
The Pew Forum has done some research about religion and voters in yesterday's election. What can we glean from this research, Dr. Carlson?
Well, in some ways, this was pretty much like 2008. Not surprisingly, Mormons went heavily for the Romney-Ryan ticket, although I'm surprised it was only 78%. I assumed it would be a lot higher. So the Mormons aren't monolithic, apparently. Catholics evenly divided, about 50-50, although if you factor out Hispanics and just look at white ethnic Catholics, a large majority went for Romney-Ryan. In fact, they appeared to pick up strength. It's possible that Ryan's position on the ticket and the fact that he is an articulate pro-life person when he's given a chance, I think may have made a difference there. On the other hand, black African-American Christians voted overwhelmingly for Barack Obama. And again, I think part of the problem there, the Romney-Ryan ticket did not reach out to them in the one way, I think, in which they might have had some results.
Dr. Alan Carlson, our guest, will be with us for a few minutes on the other side of the break. We're talking about social conservatism in yesterday's election. It's Wednesday afternoon, November the 7th. When we come back, 10 more minutes with him, and then we'll talk with Kristen Day of Democrats for Life, and we'll talk about the pro-life Democrats in yesterday's election.
I'm not a Christian, but I listen to your show because actually you do have some interesting topics.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
You believe that there's not one error in the Bible. That's intellectually infantile. You also believe that Jesus is coming again. You promote extremely sexually repressive views.
The Issues Etc. comment line. Available 24/7. 618-223-8382.
Have fun waiting for Jesus to return. Got news for you. He ain't coming back.
Does your church need a full-time or backup organist? The Virtual Organist Service from Church Music Solutions is genuine organ leadership using your instrument with your specific selections when you need it. You can try it out for free with our demo unit, which allows you and your members to hear and see the virtual organist without obligation and without a sales pitch. For more details, go to churchmusicsolutions.com.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org.
There's an app for that.
Hi, this is Jonathan Cullen from France.
Thanks to God's gift of the internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
First, I would like to say thank you very much for your program. Very much ministers to those of us who are outside the comforts and the luxuries of having a confessional Lutheran congregation nearby. Thank you very much for this great resource.
Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. IssuesETC.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Dr. Alan Carlson is our guest at the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society based in Rockford, Illinois. Dr. Carlson, much was made of statements prior to yesterday's election, statements made by Republican pro-life candidates in Missouri and Indiana. on abortion and cases of rape, incest, and the life of the mother. Do you think that this is going to be used by GOP party leaders to encourage more pro-choice Republican candidates?
Well, like I say, GOP leaders don't like social conservatives, except they want their votes. But they don't like them and don't pay much attention to them. The case of the two senatorial candidates is a pretty telling one. Neither candidate expressed the point he was trying to make very well. But the point they were trying to make is, in fact, it's one that just about anybody who's ever attended a pro-life conference that gets into the serious issues has heard that argument. About the effects of rape on women's bodies and what happens relative to conception. There was a lot of hypocrisy that came out, particularly after Congressman Aiken's comment, and many of the Republican leaders who called him and urged him to resign might have said the same thing themselves. I mean, I was kind of astonished by it. It's very possible you're going to try to see a push for more pro-choice Republicans. That's, I think, an inevitable consequence of this. Again, the party professionals are going to blame social conservatives for their own failures. By that, I mean the party professionals' failures and for their own mistakes on this campaign. That is, they didn't. The mistake they made was not grasping onto the social issues and running on them. If they'd done that, I think they would have had an easy victory.
So you said just a moment ago that GOP party leaders don't like social conservatives, but they do want their votes, and that these issues don't matter to them. What does matter to GOP leadership?
Well, I do think they, you know, first of all, first and foremost, they are the party of the business sector, without question, and particularly of the large business sector. That always matters, and I think that always trumps. The needs of business, the needs of the great corporations are always first and foremost. They're also very much in favor of a large national defense force and of a fairly aggressive foreign policy. Those matter also. Way down the list, just there mainly to rally the base, as they would say, are the social conservative issues. And they rarely bring them out. I will give George W. Bush credit. I think he really did get these things and understood. I'm not sure if his advisors were quite knew what to do with it. This time around, I saw passion with Paul Ryan. I have to say that, particularly in that vice presidential debate. He was asked his views on abortion. I thought he did a terrific job. But other than that, we saw almost nothing during the course of the campaign. Again, I think that was the key and deciding mistake.
If one more question on that, then I'll get off and talk about some specific family policies. If the GOP leadership and the party professionals, as you call them, could do it without social conservatives, would they?
Oh, I think without question. I think they'd be happy to see them go. Social conservatives came into the Republican Party really in the late 60s and mainly in the 70s. Figures like Phyllis Schlafly led the movement. And a lot of the conventional old Roman Catholic Democrats and Southern evangelicals found their party being taken over by the social sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s, and they had to go somewhere, and they went into the Republican Party. But in the long run, the Republican Party for decades had been the party of Planned Parenthood. It had been the party that had been most supportive and conducive to the eugenics movement back in the 1920s and 1930s, it was not the pro-family party, and it was not the pro-life party. And that this marriage made in the 60s and 70s, sort of one that was forced on the Republican Party. Again, remember Ronald Reagan. He was a Democrat until the 1960s, and he said he can become a Republican because the Democratic Party left him. He's symbolic of the people that came over, but deep down inside, the Republican establishment doesn't like these people, and they don't really fit in. So that there's a huge tension there that I think is going to be around for some time to come.
We talked with you, it was almost exactly 4 years ago, about the formation of a Christian Democratic Party. Is there a need for this? What would it stand for? What would it look like?
Well, there actually is a Christian Democratic Party in the United States. It was organized a few years ago. I mean, it has almost no visibility or presence, but if you look up Christian Democrats USA, as I think their website, something like that, you'll find them. They exist. What would it look like? Well, it would be pro-life. It would be pro-family. It would be sensitive to social, I mean, to tax issues, for example. It would favor family and marriage in the tax code. It would find ways to, again, encourage and support larger families, again, through beneficial tax policies and other policies. It would be Christian in all the best senses of the word, both in terms of trying to love thy neighbor, trying to have a foreign policy that's not just aggressive, but one that's also compassionate. We see examples of the Christian Democratic parties in Europe after World War II, parties that put Europe back together after the terrible wars of the first half of the 20th century. They were genuine Christians, and they understood how to reconcile the marketplace with families and with churches and small communities. That's what you'd see in a good, well-run Christian Democratic Party and government. I'd love to see such a party emerge with some strength and visibility. It's really hard, though. The rules of our election process make it really difficult for a third party to get anywhere.
What should be the top priority list, the short list of specific pro-family policies, a short list in about 30 seconds here?
Well, the one, number one that I would focus on right away, because it's always in the news, is the child tax credit. It was created in 1996, increased in 2000. Free that up from, this is a $1,000 per child credit. It's tied into the Bush tax cuts. Free it up from the other ones. You could get bipartisan majorities, a huge bipartisan majority, not just to make it permanent, but to increase it and extend it to income groups that are not covered by it now. That would be the best thing that the government can do. Cut taxes dramatically for those families that are raising children while they're raising those children.
What can we, or do you think we can win on these issues with the American public, on family, on natural marriage, on protecting life?
Well, I think we can win. No, whenever I get discouraged about the United States, I think about things that pop up almost spontaneously. One such development no one anticipated was the homeschooling movement, which came out of nowhere in the 1970s and is now mobilized and has gained political protection and fights for its rights and knows how to do it, and now embraces somewhere around 4 million American children. That's a fantastic development. And again, it reflects the social creativity of the American people. So don't despair. As all Christians know, we're going to lose along the way, but there's a great victory coming up down the road.
Dr. Alan Carlson is president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society based in Rockford, Illinois. He's distinguished visiting professor of history and politics at Hillsdale College. He was appointed by President Reagan to the National Commission on Children, and he's author of numerous books, including his latest publication, Godly Seed, American Evangelicals Confront Birth Control. You'll find a link to this book and to the Howard Center at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Carlson, thank you again. Thank you for being our guest.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
You know, we tend to lose confidence in this, and I know it's easy to become discouraged when we see elections fall, and we think these issues ought to be right there on the front burner of every American. And often they are put there on the front burner, even by our own kind of botched mistakes. They're put there for people to consider. And then you say to yourself, I know what it was like last night. You say to yourself, you know, the American people, they're a good people. We've got great founding principles. If we just act according to them, we are not going to abandon the unborn. We're not going to abandon the natural family. We're not going to abandon marriage and natural marriage. And then at least with the election of the next president, it looks like we do. And it is easy to be very discouraged. You know what I come back to? I come back to this. You can't change the truth. The truth is that unborn child is a person, a human being, who deserves protection in law. And whether our law protects that child or not, that child still deserves it, and we can't change that. That's what we mean when we talk about them having an intrinsic value. And you can't change the truth about marriage either. Natural marriage, we call it natural marriage because that's what it is. It's created into us, man and woman. And you can deny that. You can redefine that. You can define marriage as anything or everything you want it to be, but you can't change the truth. And the family is what God created the family to be. A father and a mother and children. It doesn't always work out that way, but that is what the family is, biologically and naturally. And you know what? You can't change that truth either. Now, the problem for us who care deeply about this, and I know that many of you do, the truth doesn't always prevail at the polls, does it? In fact, sometimes it just gets trampled on at the polls. But it's no reason to abandon the truth. The truth will be there whether you stick by it or not. Better off if you do. And the truth finally will prove true. In each and every case, truth is on our side, even if that isn't reflected at the polls. When we come back, Kristen Day of Democrats for Life. Right now, many churches are planning their budgets for the next fiscal year. Your church can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 on the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. Download the flyer and present it to your congregation today.
When you need a friend, you have a friend in Jesus Christ, the Good Shepherd, and friends among His people at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, Arnold, Missouri. At Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, we offer Christ-centered word and sacrament ministry, inspirational liturgical worship services, and faithful preaching and teaching. Sunday worship services are at 9 a.m. Sunday school and Bible class are at 10:30. We also have an excellent Christian preschool. We invite you to join us. Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, 2211 Tenbrook Road, Arnold, Missouri, 636-296-1292.
Here are two new ways to stay connected to Issues Etc., Facebook and Twitter. You'll find photos of in-studio guests at facebook.com/issuesetc, and you'll find a list of upcoming topics and guests on Twitter at issuesetc. Social networking for the thinking Christian, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc. Connect with fellow Issues Etc. junkies today, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues Etc. 24/7? Check out our website, issuesetc.org, and go to the Listen On Demand page. Listen at the gym, in your kitchen, in your garden, on your iPod, your computer, or in your car. The technology may be new, but the truth never changes. Issues Etc. On Demand audio, available for your convenience at issuesetc.org. 10 hours of new programming each week. issuesetc.org, and click Listen On Demand.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Redeemer Lutheran, Mandeville, Louisiana. Our Savior Lutheran, Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin. Christ Lutheran, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Emmanuel Lutheran, Louisville, Nebraska. Grace Lutheran, Warminster, Pennsylvania. Trinity Lutheran, Valonia, Indiana. Emmanuel Lutheran, Pensacola, Florida. St. Athanasius Lutheran, Vienna, Virginia. And Emmaus Lutheran, St. Louis, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Now, I think it's probably my age. It's probably the fact that I just burned myself out on politics when I was a younger man. I did. It was I lived it I ate it. I breathed it. I drank it. And I think I burned myself out. So last night I'm watching the election, and I thought I could kind of predict the way it was going to go. Nothing surprised me there. That's not because I'm a political expert. It's just because maybe I'm a pessimist. And when it was all said and done, I can't say that I was heartbroken, but then I stopped and thought about it. This is one of the last things I thought about before I went to bed. I thought to myself, four more years of a president and his party that not only refuse to protect the unborn, they're aggressively... They are aggressively in favor of those who not only, who I think have a kind of bloodthirst for the unborn, who view it as their right, a touchstone of their patriotism to keep the unborn unprotected. And I'll tell you what, that's a very depressing thought to have right before you go to bed. And I woke up with it as well. Joining us to talk about the future of the pro-life movement, in light of yesterday's election results, Scott Klusendorf, he's president of Life Training Institute. Scott, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Todd. What? I wish it were better circumstances.
You know, I went to bed with that depressing thought of four more years of this, and yes, we can get through it, and yes, this is going to we're going to work for it. But what do you say to a pro-lifer like me who is just depressed, and rightfully so, on a day like this?
Well, you're doing what you need to be doing right now, and that is to grieve. Honesty is important. We need to face the hard facts. This was not a routine election. This was a devastating loss. We are looking now at Obamacare becoming finalized. We're looking at the HHS mandate being rammed down the throats of religious organizations who will be told you either comply with funding abortion in your health care provisions or you will have to go out of business. We are looking at Supreme Court nominees who will be very hostile to our view. And most troubling to me, this seemed to me to be a worldview election. Not that it was entirely worldview, but it was dominated by a worldview clash, and our side did not win on the worldview issues. As a colleague of mine, Micah Watson, put it, look, the public knew what they were getting with Barack Obama. The first time around, he snookered them into believing he was a moderate who would pull all people together. Well, we've had 4 years. We know who this guy is. He ran on his ideology. He was very clear what he was about. The Republican convention was about trying to get women to like us. The Democrat convention was about what they wanted to do ideologically, and that view prevailed. So the first thing we need to do is face the hard facts. The second thing we need to do is wake up tomorrow morning and we need to remind ourselves that surrender is not an option. Just because our views are unpopular does not mean that they're not right. And we have no biblical grounds whatsoever for disengaging at this point. So we need to live to fight another day.
Is part of it this? That many of us, and you kind of psychologically have to do this. You think, you know, if we just get the right guy in there, and of course Romney was not necessarily the right guy, but he probably was, he certainly wasn't as wrong as he could be. If we just got him in there, and then we get those judges, and we're just looking, eyeing those three judges who are old and ready to retire, and we're thinking, man, they can't go fast enough. If we have the right president, then the court changes, then maybe we can actually make some substantial changes on the protection of the unborn. And it's a short-term goal. And I'm wondering, I guess the question come out of that is, if you knew today that Roe would never be overturned, ever, that it's permanent, would you still be pro-life? Would you still fight for the protection of the unborn?
Yes, I would, because I am commanded biblically to limit the evil insofar as possible given the realities I've been dealt. So that may mean my pro-life activism looks different than it does now, but I would still be campaigning to reduce the evil of abortion, even if I couldn't eliminate it outright. You know, Todd, I too want to see the day where Roe is reversed, and that needs to be a huge goal. We need to see the unborn protected in law. And any Christian that says right now, well, we need to disengage from the political realm and just stick to preaching the gospel, or we need to just stick to pregnancy center ministry, these people have no idea what they're talking about, and they do not understand the gravity of the moral evil in front of us. Think about where we're at, and you summed it up very well a moment ago. We have a president and a political party dedicated to the proposition that an entire class of human beings can be set aside to be killed. That is no light matter, and that demands a spiritual, moral, and political response, and we've got to do all three.
So let's talk short-term and then long-term. There, we're not getting around this. There are four more years of this president and his party, and they're going to do their level best to do what they've already done for 4 years with regard to the unborn and the life issue from beginning to end, I would say. What does the pro-life movement do for the next 4 years?
The first short-term political goal has got to be to stand our ground on the HHS mandate. We have got to do everything we can to win the fight over that in the courts. I don't know what to think about where it's going to go. I was convinced the Supreme Court would certainly not uphold the individual mandate in Obamacare, but they did. So if they do that, I don't know. Maybe I'm being way too optimistic to hope that they will strike down the HHS mandate. We shall see. At the apologetics level, here's what's good, if I can use that term. I wish I could find a different term, but I'll just use it for the sake of this discussion. Here's what's good or profitable about what's just happened. We have clarity. Defeat sometimes brings clarity. And in a worldview election where clearly competing worldviews were clashing and your side loses, it becomes very clear the road ahead of you. We have got to equip believers in Jesus to make a case for the pro-life view, and I mean every last one of them. They need to know how to argue scientifically that the unborn are distinct, living, whole human beings, and they need to argue philosophically that there's no essential difference between the embryos we once were and the adults we are today that justifies killing us at that earlier stage. We have got to be able to argue this stuff, and we don't have that. And as a result, people hear us state conclusions rather than establishing facts. The best we heard out of Mitt Romney at the GOP convention on his primetime speech was a conclusion he stated where he said, "I will respect the sanctity of life." Okay, well, that's a nice conclusion, but why aren't we arguing for it? We've got to get in there and argue for our view. Do it graciously, do it persuasively, but argue nonetheless.
Okay, with the few minutes that are left to us here, if the HHS mandate is the short-term goal, and that may take 4 years of fighting to try and mitigate that somehow, what's the long-term goal? Because we don't know what lies beyond the 4 years.
Our long-term goal ultimately is legal protection for the unborn. It's not merely changing the hearts of people. A society that condemns abortion with its lips but leaves it morally available to kill unborn children is not a moral society. A society that makes abortion rare while making it legal is a deeply immoral society. The end game here, victory with a capital V, is legal protection for unborn children. We must not abandon that field, and there's no reason we should as long as we live in a constitutional republic like ours.
Well, that means something like the repeal of Roe v. Wade, and it looks, and then from that point on, the workday has just begun. That's just the rooster crowing, isn't it?
That's correct, because reversing Roe and Doe, and presumably Casey as well, would simply return the matters to the states. Now, there are some pro-lifers like Ron Paul who said, listen, I just want it returned to the states. That's not a pro-life position. The pro-life position is that the unborn have a natural right to life, that the government has a duty, an obligation to recognize and respect. The federal government has that duty. This is not a state's issue. In fact, saying it's a state's issue is exactly the position that Justice Douglas took in his debates with Lincoln. He said he didn't care if slavery was voted up or down. Leave it to each state. Well, that's the modified pro-choice position we see today. I'm personally opposed to it, but you do what you want. You can't have it that way, and Lincoln was clear. You have no right to do what is wrong, so we've got to get legal protection for the unborn.
Finally, then, make the case. Why is the pro-life movement right?
The pro-life movement is right because it is fundamentally about human equality. Here's what we believe. Each and every human being has an equal right to life. Our opponents hold a different metaphysical view. They say it's not true that each and every human being has an equal right to life. Only some have it in virtue of some characteristic like self-awareness that may come and go in the course of your lifetime. The only way we have a society built on fundamental human equality is to pick out what it is that makes all of us equal. And what makes us all equal is we have the same human nature. If you base human equality on anything else like consciousness, self-awareness, sentience, those things come in degrees, which means human rights would come in degrees. So if we want fundamentally human equality, we've got to ground the right to life in our fundamental human nature that we all share equally.
Scott Klusendorf is president of Life Training Institute. He's author of the book, The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture. You can find out more about this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Scott, thank you very much for being our guest.
Todd, always good to be with you.
When we come back, Kristen Day is going to be our guest. We're going to talk about how pro-life Democrats fared yesterday. She's president of Democrats for Life based in Washington, D.C. 10 more minutes of Issues Etc. Live this Wednesday afternoon, November the 7th. Stay tuned.
Church's music from the 20th century. The 17th century. The 11th century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
An umbilical cord of biblical truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Why are moralism, mysticism, and speculation enemies of the Christian faith? Find out with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, Broken, 7 Christian Rules That Every Christian Ought to Break as Often as Possible. It's written by regular guest Pastor Jonathan Fisk. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can pre-order Broken by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Broken, 7 Christian Rules That Every Christian Ought to Break as Often as Possible.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the logo for the Issues Etc. Journal and Weekly Bulletin insert at issuesetc.org and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. Issuesetc.org, look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. After an election like yesterday, after every big national election, it's much easier to see the big picture than to see the trees in the forest. And I'm hoping that here in the last 10 minutes we can step back and see some of those trees, in particular trees that look like pro-life Democrats. Yes, there are pro-life Democrats. And I'm wondering whether yesterday in the individual races it was a good or a bad day for the pro-life Democratic cause. Joining us to answer some of those questions, Kristen Day, president of Democrats for Life based in Washington, D.C. Kristen, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So was yesterday a good day for pro-life Democrats?
You know, it was. It was a good day for pro-life Democrats, you know, particularly in the U.S. Senate. We were so thrilled with that. You know, we have three really solid pro-life Democrats in the Senate, and the most exciting one was Joe Donnelly in Indiana. And, you know, he ran as a pro-life Democrat, and he won, and it was very exciting.
there are many people who say that's not possible. The narrative of American politics today is, number one, there aren't any pro-life Democrats, and number two, if you ran as one, you'd never get elected.
Right. I think that's, you know, that's a myth out there, but it certainly is not true. And when you look at you know, other races, state and local races, and Michigan, Oklahoma, Missouri, Minnesota, you know, Arizona, we had successes all around the country on the state and local level, and with people running as pro-life Democrats. So, you know, we're excited. We, you know, reached a lot more people, and, you know, we feel like our membership is growing, and people are embracing pro-life Democrats, which is it's really good for.
So it sounds like you're saying at the national level there was a small but significant gain in the legislature, and then at the more local level, the state and the local level, there were other gains to be seen by pro-life Democrats.
Right, absolutely. We had a lot of pro-life you know, Democrats win in state and local races, which is really good, really positive. In fact, one of our members, Senator-elect Brandon Durst from Idaho, he won, which is very exciting because he's a member of Democrats for Life and ran as a pro-life Democrat.
What do organizations like NARAL, Pro-Choice America, think about your cause?
You know, they don't like it at all. You know, they want a pro-choice party, and they don't want Democrats, pro-life Democrats in the party at all, which from a Democratic perspective, that's such a mistake because, I mean, we look at the House and we didn't do very well in the House as a Democratic Party at all, and because you know we've lost so many pro-life Democrats over there, and we're never going to get the majority back unless we do elect pro-life Democrats.
I wonder what your thoughts are here, and many noticed this, that with the latest formation of the Democratic Party platform, what had been part of the boilerplate rhetoric in the issue of abortion, that is safe, legal, rare, and that dates from, I think, the Clinton era, if I'm not mistaken. The rare was omitted this time. What were your concerns, if any, there?
You know, we tried really hard this year to change the platform and have inclusive language for pro-life Democrats and, you know, and bring back the conscience language that we added in 1996. But, you know, unfortunately, we were unsuccessful on that front. You know, we were given the opportunity to testify, and we had very good feedback from some of the members of the platform committee. So, you know, we weren't extremely satisfied with the final language. And, you know, so, you know, 4 more years, we're going to go give it a try again and, you know, really try to move the party, you know, to be consistent with what Democratic values are. And when you look at polls and, you know, Democrats' opinions on abortion, a majority support restrictions on abortion, and a majority want it rare. So, you know, we want the platform to represent that.
So are you saying that the majority of Democratic voters are not fairly represented by President Barack Obama and his view, which would certainly not think it's something that ought to necessarily be rare?
No, you know, certainly I think most of it, I mean, when you look at, you know, parental consent and the woman's right to know and child custody protection, you know, those kinds of things, you know, it's the numbers can be in the 60s, 60% and upwards for what Democrats believe. So, you know, NARAL definitely has, a stranglehold over the party and, you know, the platform process. But, you know, we're going to continue to push on it and fight for inclusion for, you know, a majority opinion in the Democratic Party.
Does that also show us a way forward legislatively between pro-life Democrats and pro-life Republicans to reduce the number of abortions?
Yeah, you know, I think, I know pro-life Democrats, the ones that I work with, are serious about reducing abortion and eliminating abortion. And, you know, I think certainly over the past couple of years since health care reform, it's just become politicized. And, you know, we had all these votes in the House, the Republican House, that were just intended to make Democrats look bad. Pro-life Democrats look bad. It wasn't a serious attempt to make any difference, you know, and playing procedural tricks and things like that. So, you know, I think it's time now that we need to get serious. We need to work together, pro-lifers, whether you're Republican or Democrat, and really make a concerted effort to, for example, fix the contraception mandate that people are upset about, and, you know, really work to pass some pro-life legislation.
Nationally, pro-life Democrats sometimes have a reputation, and the poster boy for this in the recent past has been Bart Stupak, for being too willing to fold, too willing to compromise. What's your response?
You know, if anyone was sitting with in Bart's seat, you know, over the health care reform, and, you know, I was there, and I tell you, it was one of the toughest decisions for him to make, and, you know, and for Democrats for Life as well, because we fought to the very end. And I think the difference was between pro-life Democrats and pro-life Republicans is pro-life Democrats really wanted the health care reform bill, and pro-life Republicans didn't. So it was really easy for them to vote against it and call it an abortion bill. It was very difficult for pro-life Democrats. And, you know, we fought tooth and nail to get this, you know, the language in there. In the ACA itself, I think it's referenced five times that no money can be used for abortion. And, you know, the executive order kind of sealed that. And, you know, we think the contraception mandate is wrong and violates the ACA. So we're still continuing to correct that. And Bart absolutely did not fold. And, you know, we're proud of his efforts and we're proud to stand with him.
Will the Hyde Amendment survive 4 years of President Obama?
I absolutely it will. It's been in place since 1977. And, you know, for example, over in the House in 2010, we actually had a vote on the Hyde Amendment when Bart introduced his amendment, and we had 65 Democrats vote against it. So a majority of the country supports restrictions on federal funding of abortion. I think it's trickier when you get into, you know, restrictions such as, you know, restrictions and things on abortion, legislative restrictions such as the partial birth abortion ban and things like that, that can have very broad loopholes or very narrow. So I think those things are trickier. But when you're talking about strict federal funding for abortion, it's pretty clear. Majority of the country opposes federal funding of abortion, and I don't see that being overturned.
Two quick final questions. Who in the pro-life Democratic ranks has the potential at some point to emerge as a public voice for pro-life Democrats? So they actually exist. They're not a myth.
Well, you know, I think there's, I mean, obviously Joe Donnelly, who was just elected to the U.S. Senate, is a good strong voice, and also Senator Casey and Senator Manchin. But we also, you know, former Congresswoman Kathy Del Kemper, I think, is the strongest voice. She served one term in the House of Representatives, but I think she lived through, you know, an unplanned pregnancy, no health insurance, and collecting food stamps to support her child. So I think she is such a you know, important voice in this whole debate, when because she lived through it, and she can really talk from experience about how important support for pregnant women in crisis pregnancy is, and how, you know, if we're going to reduce abortion, we really have to focus on you know, that kind of support to help the woman carry the child to term, not just say that abortion is illegal.
Is pro-life Democrat an oxymoron?
No. I get that all the time, but, you know, I think pro-life Democrats are the most consistent whole-life legislators because, you know, they support, you know, the baby before it's born and after. And, you know, I think that they're the pro-life Democrats, they have the hardest position because of the party and the pro-life movement. Both are trying to defeat them. So, you know, they're principled and they're consistent, and we should support them.
Folks, you can find out more about Democrats for Life under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Krista Days, president of Democrats for Life, based in Washington, D.C. Kristen, thanks for being our guest.
Oh, thank you so much.
Folks, please help us defend life from beginning to end by making a tax-deductible gift to support this worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also make a financial contribution by check. Make your check payable to Issues, etc., and send it to Issues, etc., Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Here's the address again. Issues, etc., Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., we're going to talk with Dr. Dean Wenthy about the sacramental nature of the Old Testament. We'll be talking about the tabernacle and the temple and the land with Dr. Dean Wenthy. I understand he just had something named after him, a mural or something named after him up at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Also tomorrow, We'll talk about paying taxes to Caesar. It's our Pastor's Roundtable. Pastor Brian Holly and Pastor Jim Remke will be our guest tomorrow on Issues Etc. You know, if we're serious, and I know that you are, about seeing the unborn protected, about life protected from beginning to end, if you're serious about that, and I know you are, then we will take every ally we can get. We're not going to let party. We're not going to let our preconceived notions or our prejudices, no matter how well-founded we may believe they are, stand in the way. We're going to find allies wherever we can, because it's going to take those kind of allies to do the actual work that will see laws changed, regulations put into place, that will perhaps only incrementally but slowly but surely find the unborn's protection way back into our system of laws. It was shut out in 1973, and the door was locked, but we can get back in. We're just going to need all the allies we can find. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
This is Pastor Jeff Siegel of St. Mary Evangelical Lutheran Church in Des Moines, Iowa, where God gathers us around His means of grace to offer us forgiveness, life, and salvation. Whether you are looking for a church or just visiting Des Moines, if you like Issues Etc., St. Mary's is the church for you. Join us as we gather together every Sunday to continue the Reformation tradition of Christ-centered, cross-focused worship, preaching, and teaching. For more information, go to www.stmarylutheran.org. Remember to spell out saint.
At steadfastlutherans.org, we've been called contentious. We've even been called the brothers of John the curmudgeon, and we may well be curmudgeonly sometimes. But we always have the best and clearest voices in confessional Lutheranism. Articles from Molly Hemingway, Martin Nolan, Clement Preuss, Todd Wilkin, and a host of regular contributors. Come check out the new Lutheran media. Always clear, always concise, always confessionally Lutheran. steadfastlutherans.org.